profile interview.
Her name is Siba Balwe Siba Sesmani. Siba, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time.
Good evening, Obi. Thank you so much for having me on your show. How are you doing?
I'm well, man. All the better for having you join us this evening, because I'm really looking forward to the conversation about not only the unorthodox group, but also some of the clients that you service. I mean, I'm looking at big names such as Magazole Mampimpi and Lukanyo AM, Jaden Hendricks, Babalwala Cha, Soccer Star Tebo Homokwe, and the list goes on and on and on and on. What does the unorthodox group do?
So an unorthodox group was started close to 10 years ago as an unorthodox PR and media group, where we focus purely on facilitating media interviews for our corporate clients. So mostly we service organizations. So about 4 years ago, close to 4 years ago, we were then given an opportunity to represent one of the professional athletes that you've actually named. So we decided, after working with this one client, we saw a huge gap in the South African market in the sense that professional athletes were not represented from a brand endorsement perspective. And we also started getting a bit of interest from other such players as well. After we worked with one athlete, and we decided to solidify it and register an entity. So an Orthodox Group is then the holding company of the two subsidiaries, which is an Orthodox PR, how it all started, of which we still facilitate interviews. Then the second entity to fall under an Orthodox group is in an Orthodox PR, where we source brand endorsement deals for our athletes, sponsorships for teams, but we also help our athletes plan for retirement as well, which we've seen in the past is a huge problem with just athletes.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I've had conversations with guys I come from, Mamelodi with, that were, I mean, superstars in the football space, that are really eking out a very, very, very unfortunate living at the moment. And because of the fact that perhaps the education and the knowledge of preparing themselves for the reality of post sporting success wasn't really dealt with. Is that what the unorthodox group does? Help athletes develop a better plan for their life post the stardom?
No, definitely. And we actually start while you're at your peak. And it's important, because when you're at your peak as a professional athlete, you have multiple sources of income coming in. You've got your own salary, which is more than enough to live on. But then brands want to be affiliated with you, which is the work that we do, to then secure those brand relationships. But I think we go a step beyond to say that you've got all of this additional income. You really don't need all of it from a month-to-month expenditure. So how's about we work backwards? Because number one, a professional athlete career is very short. Even if they're privileged enough to get to a point where they retire voluntarily, but also there's that option that involuntary retirement can also come into it. So I think, when you orthodox sport, we have a questionnaire where we want to know where your interests lie, because when you retire, you do obviously want to do something that you are interested in, that you love, but also it can take care of you. And it's another non-sports maybe related interest as well. So we actually start planning backwards, and if it's a structure that we need to put in place and run with it until you retire, then we'll do that. But we've also recently partnered up with an FSP, where we're going to make an exciting announcement about that, to say, let's take care of your finances. Let's look at post-retirement, what can be put in place. And fortunately for us, those FSPs also have quite a bit of experience as professional athletes. So realizing that they've got very short careers and very high income, and how to maximize that as much as we can. Because, I mean, for us, if a client post-retirement is so successful, it's good PR for us. It guarantees that we also get good clients going forward. So it's a win-win situation for everyone, really.
It sounds to me that the model for the securing of a better financial future for these stars is probably similar to that which financial advisors would use, that the model is similar, that in your case, you're dealing with high net worth individuals who are very, very talented and they are doing great things. But the model seems quite germane.
It is. No, it very much is. So I think with us, we view sport very holistically and not just on the field, in the sense that, I mean, sports in itself has a trickle-down benefit to so many. The value chain of sports through an athlete being on the field is just so vast in itself. So just exploring those opportunities and exploring other avenues. And I think as an Orthodox sport as well, we try as much as we can to educate about the value chain of sport and not just on the field. So things such as partnering up with SSPs is for us a good service provision that we can also bring in. And it also brings us a unique selling point versus other agencies that also do the same. But we've got a very centralized approach to make sure that our client needs to be taken care of from a holistic level, which then where the FSP...
What does that mean, Siba? What does that mean?
So holistic for us, I mean, we've had instances where we feel as though an athlete might need or benefit from therapy services, for instance. So we'll bring that up. We'll have those conversations. Because once you manage individuals, these are people that you talk to every single day. You know, it's not just, after 5 o'clock, I'm done with this individual. Individuals take a lot of time. And individuals are very intricate. We do treat every single sporting client as a company, but, you know, they're not as straightforward as a company as well. So it's not just, getting enough brand endorsement deals, hence why we also help them plan for a time because they are a person. But there's other avenues as well to just ensure that they're the best person they can be. Therefore, we can extract as much value for them, also for a long period of time. So longevity is quite important for us. Consistency is also quite important for us. So I think when we say holistic, it's not just one area of their lives because you interact with people. Also, it's a long-term relationship, so it's not just as cutthroat. But what we basically want to do is that the athlete, as an athlete and as a person and a human, we have ensured that we put enough measures in place, so that that athlete can, we can derive the best value from that athlete as we possibly can.
My guest is the CEO of the Unorthodox Group, Siba Balwe. Siba Sesimane, and we're talking about their business. And how long has the Unorthodox Group been around for, you say?
So the first entity, Unorthodox Pure Media Group, we are turning 10 years old in October. And then the sports agency is turning 4 years old in October. I don't know what it is about October and us starting entities then, but hey, it seems like a winning formula.
That's when the stars align, Siba. That's when the stars align,
quite
man.
Clearly, don't they say that the is it the African or is it the Zulu New Year starts in September? But clearly, September, October, there's something is special that's happening. So yeah, those two entities are respectively. That's how long we've been around for.
No, definitely. And Siba herself, how did she get into this business, into this space, media communication space? Business that has been running for 10 years is a force to be reckoned with. I mean, you know the story that most businesses fold after 3 years. You guys have been running for 10 years and more subsidiaries. How do you come across all of this? Were you part of the founding team? How did it come about?
So, Obi, I think in order to be an entrepreneur and to actually get to year 10, you have to be like a bit of a nuts job, to be quite honest. No, honestly, if you're not a nuts job already, you turn into one because we, especially in the black community and then being a woman and being young, you don't see a lot of other females that walk the journey with you. So I think in my case, to reference back to my story, I actually come from a Bachelor of Commerce majoring in economics and econometrics background from the University of Johannesburg. That's my actual qualification that I studied. Ended up working for 18 months, I think for 3 or 4 different entities in those 18 months. And then the last time I was officially an employee before I became my own company's employee, I found my first client, of which I looked at how much my client is paying me salary-wise, how much I was being paid, compared costs. I have to be at work every single day. I work for myself. I don't really have to be at work. So I can cut out the transport costs, and I just made a decision there. I think for me, it's always because I've always known that I can always fall back to my qualification if somehow the entrepreneurship and the business side of things didn't work. But it just showed a lot of potential. My age also, I think, sort of helped me, because at that point, I didn't have a lot of responsibilities. I was only 22. So I could take on more risk. And the more risk I took on, the more I forged forward and could sacrifice in my entrepreneurial life earlier on. I guess it then led us to turning to 10 years old this year and then still being around. So the entity, Unorthodox PR and Media Group, I then own 100%. But with the sports agency, I do have 2 other shareholders, still myself being majority. So that's how almost the 2 entities came about. And, you know, 10 years, close to 10 years later, I guess, yeah, we're still around.
Where did you grow up, Siba?
Funny enough, I am at that place right now, while sort of traveling to another place, but I grew up in Tanzania, second largest township, I think, in South Africa. Went to school in East London. After that, then went to UJ first year in 2011, done by 2013. Obviously, then graduated the next year.
I'm fascinated by entrepreneurs. I'm deeply fascinated by entrepreneurs because they are people who look for ways to solve a problem.
Of course.
And then they find a way to monetize the solving of that problem. And in that way, they create value.
Yes.
And for me, that is probably the most desperately needed skill this country needs. And I sometimes feel like we are losing the opportunity of creating a group of people that understand that any country's economy needs people that are going to look for problems for the purpose of solving them and creating value, right? So I'm fascinated by the Sibabalwas of this world and the kind of mindset that they've developed, which is rare, the kind of mindset that says, oh, okay, maybe I'll take the risk and do this thing myself, and 10 years later have an organization that adds value, that is tax paying, that is employing people, that is that has prospects for growth. So I'm very, very fascinated by that, and many, many other reasons. But I find that the entrepreneurs themselves have drank a particular Kool-Aid. They have believed a certain set of values. They've come from a particular background that sets them up to become who they later become. That's why I always ask the question about where did you grow up? What was it about growing up in Mdantsane that created Sibabalwa, who is now the CEO of the Unorthodox Group? If you recall, if you take your mind back, what was it about your upbringing that you think created this entrepreneur?
I would like to agree. Initially, it was purely financial. I think, you know, the typical South African story is that a lot of black families grew up in a financial deficit, right? So I hated hearing the word no to the things that I wanted as a child, and you also don't understand. because I was also very fortunate enough to, I don't know if it's still politically correct, to still go to a Model C school when my dad, very typical, was a teacher. My mom was an admin clerk. You know, the usual typical black parents' jobs back then. So it, for me, it was the no. And I know I knew that the no didn't come from a malicious place. It was simply that we could not afford.
Yeah.
So I think from when I was young, I'd always promised myself that that's not going to be the life I'm going to have for forever, and it's not going to be the life that I'm going to have for my future kids. So it was always that in mind. So I probably started, I don't want to say business because it wasn't registered, but I started, you know, my friends used to compliment me when I was very, very young on my clothes. So we, you know, when I was very, very young, I think we were in a financially better position. I knew that twice a year we'd go shopping. So I started selling some of the clothes that my friends would compliment me on. And this is when I was probably 7 or 8. And I had a little logbook in the Eastern Cape. Teachers always used to get paid on the 20th. And a lot of, from where I grew up, a lot of parents were teachers. So, you know, they'd lay by, I guess. You can put it like that. And then on the 20th, I'm there with my notebook. And I know who owes me money, so I'm going and I'm collecting. So I'm not the tallest.
How old were you then?
I was probably like 6 or 7. I don't know. Somewhere they're very young though. And then that happened. I think my mother then found out because we used to give away clothes. But I didn't have clothes to give away all of a sudden. And then she found out about my secret business that I'm actually having. So I got into trouble for that. And then after that, I did not give up. I started a popcorn business. And then for my popcorn business, I learned my first business rule that you don't lend money to family because it won't come back.
Yeah.
Popcorn was, I think, 50 cents at the time. And our local newspaper was 2.50 rand. So, you know, the guys would sell it at the traffic light.
Yeah.
So my dad would always ask me so that he can give the guy quickly and grab the newspaper without needing change. So that's how I ran out of money. Because when I have to ask for money back from my dad, he would say, you know, who do you think buys the Kellogg's and the Colgate? And now you want your money back. So I was also very young then, probably still primary school, but I think that's where it started. So I bought my first cell phone when I was 11 years old, Motorola C190. I asked my parents for it. They said no. I said, if I can raise half, would you give me the other half? They said yes. Raised half for that Motorola C190. And then they said, no, you can keep it. We'll buy your first phone at 11 years old. You know, I would get my parents into a meeting where we negotiate for things that I wanted. I'll give you this, you give me that. Growing up, I'm not quite sure where I picked that up, but when I was younger, I've always wanted to be financially independent. And I've always known that, you know, I want to live in abundance. So purely motivated, financially motivated at first. But I think once you start seeing the problems as an entrepreneur, you start seeing the social issues around it that you're also solving. So I do say sometimes what's dragged me all these years up until now is the fact that I get to wake up and do what I love and enjoy. It pays me. It pays the people that we also work with. And we are also solving social ills through being paid. So it's possibly one of the most beautiful things that can happen to a person in fulfilling your life's purpose, really, being comfortable financially, changing other people's lives all at the same time.
I wish we had a better line. My guess is Sibabalwa Siba Sesmani. I hear everything you're saying, but I wish we had a better line, Siba. You speak about the mindset of abundance. Growing up in the reality of scarcity and lack, relatively so. Where did the idea that there's abundance come from? I mean, your immediate reality, your immediate experiential life was such that there was relative scarcity, which is why you desired abundance. But how did you know of the existence of abundance? How did you sense that there is an abundance that you can be a part of, even though your direct experience was scarcity and lack.
Sure. Yeah, no, I must apologize for the light up on the road. But I think for me, the best thing that's ever happened is the fact that I changed school. So my first primary school was at a school, a typical school back in the day, Elokshini, where there's 50 kids in the classroom. You know, corporal punishment is very normal. It's a thing. Kids are coming from different backgrounds. And then, you know, one day I just decided with my parents that I don't want to be at the school anymore. And I forced them to make a plan. I then moved to a better school again, a school politically correct model. So now there's like, 15 of us, from 50 to 15 of us in a classroom. You know, now there are kids of other races. You go to this one's house, you see how big the house is. You inquire about what the parents do. They own 4 or 5 petrol stations. This one's parents has a shop in one of the local malls. This one goes on holiday to the south of France or somewhere in Italy. So I think just for me, that exposure of changing environment showed me that there's a different world to the world that I was in previously. And then I started seeing there's so much more to the world. There's so much more abundance. And I think from then onwards, I was just more aware and also wanted to expose myself as much as I can. And it became a reality because now you're friends with people that travel the world every holiday, even though you might not, but then they spark an interest in you. So therefore, you go on the internet, you research about that part of the world, and then it's just a hole that you get trapped in, and you learn it through other people till you get to a point yourself where you can afford to physically explore what you've always read about in theory or experience secondhand from other people.
One of the things that thinkers and writers about entrepreneurship, particularly those people who come from backgrounds of poverty, always speak about the PhD syndrome. Pull her or pull him down syndrome, the proverbial story of the crabs that keep pulling each other down and so forth. And it is a reality of most poor communities throughout the world that when one of us starts to think about other realities and other than those that we have, we start naming them, we start calling them names, we start making them feel a little bit weird. Did you have to encounter some of that?
Of course. First of all, before I even changed school, in the school that I was an A student, and I was teased for being an A student. You know, the strangest thing. I then changed school, and you find that, you know, obviously now the kids that you've grown up with maybe are also not going to those schools. So it's and you're actually not spending that much time with them because now they're extramurals. You're coming back home late. And then it's that whole name calling. You think you're better because you don't hang out with us anymore. Maybe you start speaking more English or your English is a bit more refined purely because of the change in the environment. And from half past 7 till about 5 p.m., that's all you're doing. So you must remember to come back because also my mother was like, you leave that English at the gate when you enter my house. And my house is biggest cost. Like, yes, ma'am. So there's also that, but you are right. Sometimes you grow out of your environment, but before you can actually physically go out, because you change so much as a person, there's the growth and the good that you go through often is not recognized by the people that are not on the same trajectory, and it gets isolating, it gets lonely, and then the pull him or her down syndrome kicks in when, you know, now you're being name called purely for just moving up or wanting better or wanting that additional exposure.
Did it affect you in a particular way, that reality, that estrangement, that an alienment from home, from community, because you were starting to think differently, desire different things, have a different trajectory, even though it hadn't fully manifested yet, but you were already changing. You were already, it sounds like to me, it sounds like you were already desiring different things and therefore making certain choices about being with certain people and not being with certain people. Tell me about that space. Tell me about that journey and how did it affect you?
I think as a child, you don't fully grasp what's going on. So you're very emotional. You don't understand why, you know, some of these people, you grew up with playing dolls with teaching you, or treating you like this or treating you differently. But I always say that as an entrepreneur, you need to have something that anchors you, whether you believe in the universe or God or whatever it is that you believe in. Unfortunately, that vision is only given to you and you are the only one who ever understand it. Mm. So being okay with that must also be okay. With the fact that it's you and your entity that you believe in for the longest time, because people also want to believe in a physical manifestation. And then, you know, then later on in life, people are like, oh, this is what you are building towards. No wonder you had to be a bit different. But I think when you're a lot younger, you don't fully grasp that. But then when you're older, that's how also entrepreneurs have to grow up very quickly, because...
Oh, Siba, there you go. I lost you for a second there, Siba. You were saying that as an entrepreneur, you've got to grow up very quickly?
You have to grow up very quickly because part of entrepreneurship is not just the tangible things, but also the intangible. You must be able to grasp certain concepts that physically you cannot touch, but your emotional maturity must kick in, your awareness, your discernment must kick in as well. And you learn those, unfortunately, by being burned, by experimenting, by things not working out. But those are some of the intangible skills that you also have to hone in and have as an entrepreneur. So it does affect you in the sense that, you know, I've noted myself included and other entrepreneurs, you always have this almost, I can do anything. I don't need anyone because of that isolation that you had because people did not understand you before. But you then need to come back and unlearn the fact that, no, you actually do need people because entrepreneurship is an ecosystem. And to get business, sometimes it's a referral. It's you needing a team, you needing freelancers. So you'll find that often entrepreneurs actually just capacitate your business is something that we may struggle with because we believe that no one can do it better than us. But after a while, you just can't do everything by yourself. And that's when you actually need people. So it needs a lot of self-awareness and being able to self-correct as you go as well. But, you know, those things and isolation does affect you, but you need to then be able to point it out and then deal with the problem decisively in order for you to continue to the future more successfully.
I think what I'm hearing you say is that in the process... In the journey, you go through a number of epiphanies.
Yes, definitely.
And one of them is, first of all, that because you're kind of weird, you believe certain things. You believe in abundance, in scarcity. I mean, in a context of scarcity, because you choose to learn certain things that aren't perhaps mainstream in that context, and so forth. You then get isolated by those kinds of decisions, and then you start to think that you can do things all by yourself. But then you grow through the journey of discovering that you do need people. You need people in order for you to be catapulted to the next level of your journey. It sounds to me like you are saying that you always need people. What is different, what is key is the nature of the relationships you have with those people. Is that what you're saying?
No, definitely. You hit the nail on the head.
So part of why I'm fascinated by the Sibas of this world, and they are few and far between, is because I am trying to figure out whether the entrepreneur is a product of community and society, or it is a matter of a process that goes on within that person?
Mm.
And what is the relationship between those two variables? Let me tell you why I'm preoccupied with that.
Sure.
Because many people who are entrepreneurs often come from backgrounds of scarcity, of difficulty, and so forth. But then something happens that this child that doesn't want to give me the 250 for the newspaper, this child that demands their money back while I'm the one that is buying the Kellogg's, this little difficult one that challenges my authority and the authority of the church and the authority of the political party and the authority of the culture and the this one, this strange child who's grown up with all of these other children is the one that ultimately becomes the lily that grows through the difficult tar road, grows right through all of that. I'm trying to figure out, can we teach that? Can we multiply that? Can we create more Sibas? Is that a possibility? Or is this just a matter of luck and happenstance, spiritual alignment in October? You know what I mean? Can we?
I honestly think that it's a tough one. You know, we're not all meant to be entrepreneurs. You know, everyone wants to, you know, while I'm working, I can start this and I don't have to work. And, you know, entrepreneurs, and we're actually essentially lying to people and saying that everyone can be an entrepreneur. Number one, not for everyone. Number two, not everyone also wants to be an entrepreneur.
Sure.
And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely, yeah.
I do believe, I'm not quite sure how other entrepreneurs or everyone and anyone else perceives it, but I honestly believe that it's a combination of awakening what's already there or what you were already born with, and then combining it with, I don't know, just environmental factors maybe around you, but there's a certain level of, sacrifice, tenacity, being able to withstand a lot of difficult and hard positions, because the reason why there aren't more billionaires and millionaires in the world is just simply because of sacrifice, and who's willing to sacrifice and to what extent. I purely believe that success and your level of success is based on what you're willing to sacrifice.
Yeah.
And we look up to these people and we don't know what they've had to sacrifice in order to get there, but we want to be them. So I really think it is a myriad of factors and things. Some people believe entrepreneurs were born, I don't know. Some people honestly believe that it's something that can be taught. But what I'm very happy about is that from when we started 10 years ago, I now see more people like myself. There are other young women that are starting businesses that have been around for long in different sectors, in PR and eventing and sports. In mining, there's a lady that I met where her and her sister run a factory where they make bricks from plastic, you know, very male-dominated. They have to get into the construction industry, basically. So for me, I think it's easier for someone to say, maybe I can do this entrepreneurship thing. And there's a bit more of us that can now do the coaching to say, okay, here's the learning, and this is what I can give you knowledge-wise. And then there's that element of learning, because now I'm passing on knowledge to you, but that there is also that element of what is within you and you really want to fulfill that.
What do you think of entrepreneurial courses at institutions of learning?
Please, can you repeat that, Aubrey?
What do you think of courses like a degree in entrepreneurship or a course in entrepreneurship? What do you think of that?
I don't think it's necessarily too bad, because some of us have had to just learn on the go things that can actually, be put on a textbook. So I do think that the fundamentals can be taught. There's a lot that can be taught, I think. But also that needs to be coupled up with practical experience as well. Speak to seasoned entrepreneurs, get our most honest opinions and our experiences as well, because you also need to decide if this is the kind of life that you want for yourself, because it's very hard. Being an entrepreneur is very hard, and there's something that a book simply cannot teach you.
What is hard about being an entrepreneur?
I think one thing that I touched on is that we actually just touched on is the isolation bit. No one really, I was actually having a conversation just before this call about how when you're building something and you have a vision that no one else sees, there's a lot of isolation. And what hurts the most is your closest friends and family sort of moving away from you because you come across as crazy. So those are some of the things, you know, how to still continue when you don't have a cent in your bank account, because with most South African entrepreneurs that come from a background similar to mine, you might be getting kicked out in the morning by a landlord being threatened, but you still need to put on a poker face to go into a meeting and make sure that you seal that. So also being an entrepreneur means that your emotions are never stable. You go through really good moments and really bad moments. And it's very emotionally exhausting, but you then find ways to cope and deal with that. And you become seasoned in coping and dealing with that over time. So there's a lot that I don't know if it's an entrepreneur course, but for instance, we've been around for 10 years. Since day one, we've always had an office, but we never paid for an office space. So your negotiation skills, how are you negotiating? How are you bartering? Because being an entrepreneur, you must also be okay with the fact that you're probably only going to see money after 5 years to be able to pay for stuff. But how are you making sure that you have a world-class website? You know, ask for a world-class website to be done, offer your services. So there's a lot of bartering that goes into it. I'm not sure if in courses they cover that. There's a lot of free resources as well. You actually sit down with entrepreneurs, and because we also have a problem with that in our country, is that we have people that are advising and they're in positions where they. If you actually sit down with entrepreneurs, if you are a Gibbs or UJ or Vitz, and say, okay, from a practical experience, how can we bring this into our entrepreneurial course? From a theory perspective, how do we then bring that in and create a module that is a bit more relatable and equips people a bit better? You'll never be fully equipped for entrepreneurship, but at least you have experts that have been around and are entrepreneurs. And then you also have the theory part of it, which can be research. And therefore, you're able to produce a more realistic entrepreneur rather than just textbook, because you'll be very shocked from textbook.
Yeah. I'm fascinated also, amongst the many things that I'm fascinated about, Siba, is the relationship that we have with credentials. So somebody goes to a university or TVET college or whatever institution of learning, does an entrepreneurial course, gets the certificate, and boom, I have this thing. And there are certain expectations connected to that, in the same way that you would have expectations for a job if you've got a degree in accounting or law, or and I watch how many people who have these degrees or courses in entrepreneurship are hit with this rude awakening. That I wish somebody would divulge and explain. That makes me feel like there's a big exploitation thing going on here. Because it feels like people aren't being told the full story about what entrepreneurship actually is. And that's why I asked you the question of what do you think about these courses? And I agree with you, there are things that can be learned. We just, as you said, need to be a little bit relatable. I want to ask you another question.
Sure.
There are seminars very often organized by government or by government, and you know it's an Indaba.
Don't like where this question is going.
Fill in the gaps for me. I'm not gonna fill in the gaps for me.
I think the question is going to be, how helpful are those seminars? Or is it me? Is this me projecting now?
So we'll have the mining in Durban. We'll have the black industrialists. What? And it's nice. I suppose it's great. We have a politician speak, and we have a sociologist speak. And very, 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 very seldom do you hear the entrepreneur speak at these things, right?
But then, so that's where the huge problem comes in, because for me, we want to hear from the politician in terms of a policy.
Yep.
So what policies are being implemented, you know, that they are then the experts when it comes to this. We also want to hear from the different funding institutions that should we knock on your door. What are the do's and don'ts? What is currently available? But most of all, before we even get there, we want to actually hear from the entrepreneur, just giving real-life knowledge and minimizing, I guess, or managing expectations so that people can actually say, you know, I don't think this entrepreneurship thing is for me. I hear the funding, that's great. I hear the policies, but the entrepreneur is then coming with real-life knowledge. I think, you know, just me now as a person, I don't go to seminars or endeavors or whatever anymore. I used to, but also I had a plan as to, okay, I want to engage this person. Maybe on email they're not responding, so therefore I know if I'm in the same room I can engage this person. You know, this is whoever's contact that I'm looking for, and so forth, which is something that I still apply today before I just go to an event. I'm not going to go for the sake of saying that I was there because my time is valuable. I could have been making money or sleeping. But I think you also need to have a clear purpose as to why you are attending these mining endeavors, for instance. And for me as a startup, it doesn't make sense for you to spend so much money on a mining endeavor. That's number one. The ticket is priced at a foreign currency. Number two, it's in Cape Town. We all know that Cape Town is not the cheapest place to be at. But number three, we know that you're not going to meet the real decision makers because those meetings have already been had. If you want to have information, if you want to be within the network and increase your chances of meeting a certain person, maybe in a restaurant, yes. But we also need to be honest with ourselves and say, what value and what practical knowledge am I getting out of this that I can immediately implement that might not necessarily benefit me now, but possibly in the mid to long term, you know, going to that certain endeavor or Inviso would actually help me. Because some of them really, from the organizer's perspective, is a tick box exercise. And then some of them, you know, are helpful to other people depending on where we are in our business walk.
I mean, you were in that space, organizing events of this nature at some point, and it was part of your business, right?
Yes.
Did you ever think about some of the considerations that you're talking about now?
I think for us, it wasn't part of our business from a financial perspective. But, you know, as an entrepreneur, even though I started in the space on a purely financial basis, I think I did mention that you end up seeing social ills and then you then organize events. I think I remember as far back as 2016, you know, I've always had a passion to empower women through business. So we'd engage the stakeholder. So just as long as we have a venue and we can feed people, you know, sponsorship and all of that can come last. And it was all about creating a network for women in business. You know, that became a bit too much for us. We couldn't sustain it, so therefore we stopped. But I think over time and gathering information, for instance, with our events that's coming up now, the 18th of April, Women in Sports Symposium. That's all about educating women and creating awareness about the value chain of sport. But we've emphasized to every panelist that's coming that we need something that people can immediately implement when they leave. So also practicality and also longevity, which is something that we feel passionate about. How are people actually benefiting? Because if you look at a lot of women empowerment events, it's empowerment. Not, women have all the necessary skills to prove it over and over on the field, at work, that we're actually very capable. But we just need external bodies to come to the party now. That's literally it. we're done. We're qualifications. We've done that. We've ticked off all the boxes. But we need external organizations to come to the party and just do what they're supposed to do. so that women are fairly compensated.
My suspicion is that if they don't come to the party, the external bodies, if they don't come to the party, you guys are going to make the external things yourselves.
I have no doubt,
no fear about that. How does Sibabalwa Siba Sesimane fill her cups? How do you fill your cup? How do you replenish your own energy and your centeredness, your sanity, especially as you've said that sometimes your own mind comes under a lot of... How do you do that?
I pray quite a bit. I pray quite a bit. And I think also that I've mentioned, I think as a person, and you know, and more especially if you're going to be in business, you need to believe in some form of higher power. Otherwise, you're going to go mad because there's actually a lot that we're not in control of. So you need that belief that, hey, someone is advocating for you to win in this life, or an entity is advocating.
So have you found that works for you?
For me, it works. It's one of the things that work. And then I think just being able to see your good works through your entrepreneurial journey. I mean, I'll get a random DM on Instagram saying, oh my God, you inspire me so much from a distance, from someone that I don't know. The other day, we were contacting quite a well-known agency in Joburg, and the guy that I was dealing with there said, he's like a senior public relations specialist now. He's like, the reason why I'm in this position that I am, because you planted a seed in me years ago when I was interning for you. Siba, and now I am where I am.
Got to stop. What a wonderful conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed your candor, your sensitivity. I really enjoyed talking to you. How do people get in touch with you?
Sure. I mean, we are on all platforms on social media as Unorthodox Group. On LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, so people can DM us. Also, they can find our emails on all of those bios on our social media platform. Quite responsive to that as well. Our office line is there. The business addresses across all of the platforms. And of course, they can also DM me personally if they can just look up my name and surname. If it's a good fit for our company, reach out. We can also direct you in other avenues as new consciousness.
Sibabalwe Siba, thank you so much for joining us. I really, really have enjoyed talking to you. She is the CEO of the Unorthodox Group. Thank you so much for joining us.